Well, that's not a reason not to fix it. That's actually the reason to fix it. We've turned off all our cards. A help desk cannot prevent a ticket the same way a hospital ER cannot prevent a heart attack. That's a $213 billion problem. You really got to believe in it.
Welcome back to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman with Intellectual Strategies, and I get the pleasure of talking with some really smart people, CEOs who are building businesses, and talking about a few of the things in their, what I like to call their breakout journey or their breakout arc, right? What were they building? What broke it? What broke or got disrupted their momentum? What was the breakout moment where they kind of worked through that disruption? And then what's the breakthrough where the business headed, maybe even where they personally kind of reoriented themselves or headed in a new direction? So that's the breakout arc. And today we've got Jevon LaRue joining us with, he's with Kiyu. Jevon, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. And there's like three lots of tough words over there. Jevon, LaRue, and Kiyu, all not easy to pronounce, and you cracked it. Well done.
If I say it rhythmically, I might get it to sound like a rhyme even.
Yeah, so. It does feel that way.
Jevon LaRue, CEO of Kiyu, or something like that, right?
Oh, rhyme, isn't it?
So, hey, well, it's good to have you on the show. I'm really excited about this because as I think about what you're building with Kiyu and the little bit we've talked up until this point, like I think there's a real problem here that you're addressing, and you're trying to address it not by resolving it when it happens, but resolving it before it even happens. And that's in the e-commerce space with Wizmo or Where Is My Order, right? Where like customers saying, I thought I was going to get this, or it's not on its way yet, or it didn't arrive, or whatever it is, right? This is the problem that you're addressing. I'm going to give a little analogy here, and I don't know why this pops into my mind, but the thing that comes to mind for me is Pixar movie, The Incredibles, and the scene that comes to mind is when, boy, is it Frozo? I don't remember the guy, and he's like, "Honey, where is my super suit?" You know, because he sees chaos happening outside his window, and he's like, "I gotta go grab my suit and go help." And he goes to grab his suit behind, I think his bed flips around or something like that, and there's no suit there. He's like, "Where is my super suit?" And I just that's what when I read about your business, I'm like, I think a lot of customers are doing that same thing, right? They're like, "Hey, e-commerce company, where is my product? Where is it? Why isn't it here yet? And why have I not heard anything? If it's not going to come on time, I need some information. Can you help me?" Did I get the problem right? Even though I maybe twisted the analogy a little bit.
Yeah. Well, there's probably two parts to that problem. One, there's the customer that says, "Where is my order?" Uh-huh. And then there's a customer that doesn't say, "Where is my order?" But they didn't get their order on time. And so both of those are dangerous. So if you think about it, like last year, one in five online shoppers in the US didn't get what they ordered on time as promised. And it's huge.
Yeah.
That's a $213 billion problem for e-commerce businesses, revenue that left silently. And so there's two parts. Those that actually call in and become a help desk ticket, and they're asking, "Where is my order?" Uh-huh. And then there are those that don't say anything, but they're upset and they just leave. And
really?
That's the silent problem.
What's the split between those?
I just know that the data around carriers saying that one in five online shoppers didn't get their order, that means those parcels didn't meet the delivery SLAs. And mm-hmm. So part of the big misconception about this problem is, oh, it's a carrier problem. Well, it's not. It's actually everything that happens upstream before a customer gets an order. So it's like your Shopify, is it syncing correctly? Is your inventory allocated correct? Are your styles loaded correctly? Is the payment system working fine? Is the warehouse shipping it out of the warehouse okay on time? There's just all of these sort of system issues and process issues and people issues that are greater than just a carrier getting a parcel lost or a carrier getting a parcel delayed. And so all those minute failures that happen between order placement, deliver and return, help desks don't know they exist. And a help desk is like a hospital ER. It cannot prevent a heart attack. A help desk cannot prevent a ticket the same way a hospital ER cannot prevent a heart attack.
Okay.
It can only triage it after something's gone wrong. So what we figured out is if we can identify that something going wrong before it becomes the customer's problem and automate fixing it, the ticket never exists. The frustrated customer goes away, and customers will always get what they want on time.
Yeah. You make it sound easy, but there are, as you kind of hinted at there, I think, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of moving parts here. I feel like it seems like this is a business that you chose to get into on the complex side, right? There are some really simple businesses or simpler business models, but you've picked one that is relatively complex, right?
It is extremely complex. And I think, if I remember correctly, when we went out 2.5 years ago, and my co-founders and I have been in e-commerce for a while, and we've run big e-commerce businesses, and we lived this problem, right? We lived it. There was a crisis where 1,000 shoppers placed orders at one of our companies. The stock didn't exist. We had to credit and refund 1,000 customers and send them emails and say sorry. It's terrible. And we lived that kind of pain. So we knew the problem existed. We didn't realize how hard it was going to be to actually solve it. We built an MVP. It delivered a bunch of results. We're like, oh, yeah, cool. We've crushed it. And I remember going out to fundraise, and there was this very well-known e-commerce founder in Australia that had sold his business to a NASDAQ-listed SPAC. He sold it for $600 million, and he was seen as the guru in e-commerce in Australia. And he was doing some angel investing, and we were like, hey, do you want to invest in us? And he went, you can't fix this problem. It's impossible.
Oh.
It can't be fixed. And we kind of all turned to each other and said, well, that's not a reason not to fix it. That's actually the reason to fix it. Because if it's that broken that it can't be fixed, it has to be fixed. And foolishly, we decided to go down that path. And I often say to people, it's as if we're almost building a complex deep tech stuff. Like, it's really, really hard to stitch all of these systems together that are managing an order. You think about it. You've got a shop front, a payment gateway, order management, inventory management, a warehouse management, an ERP. You've got a carrier integrator, carriers, multi-geo warehouses, ship from store, click and collect, return solutions, marketplaces, TikTok shop, Facebook, Walmart, and you throw in a help desk. We're stitching that all together in one platform. And we often say we've got more data than Google has on its customers. As far as for that e-commerce business, we can provide more insights into the health of e-commerce operations than Google Analytics can on shopping.
That's amazing. And it sounds like you've got more integrations than Amazon. You might have been better off starting a new Amazon than integrating all these other platforms together or something.
So, Jeff, right now I kind of do feel like that. I'll be very honest with you. I was reflecting on how easy it was for Amazon to start just actually yesterday, when it was like, how smart was Jeff Bezos back in the late 90s when he was like, I'm just going to do books.
Yeah.
How did you go from just doing books to sending rockets to space? It's just amazing, right?
It totally is.
And that's a bit of a pivot along the way, but we certainly have had a few pivots as we've been building this.
Yeah, well, we're gonna get into some of those. But before we do, tell me about your team. And you know, you guys had experience in e-commerce, but how did you really, you know, resolve that this is the problem you want to tackle? What was that like for your team?
Yeah, so I think the three of us all worked together at a really well-known activewear brand in Australia called PE Nation. In fact, it was doing really well globally. It had a collaboration with H&M, just absolutely exploded during COVID. And we're all working there together. I was the CEO building and growing the company. And my other co-founder was leading customer service and e-commerce operations. And the other was, we hired him as the CTO to build the systems to scale the business. So we were there, and there was this like moment I was talking about a bit earlier, where 1,000 customers bought products that were not in the warehouse. The systems didn't sync. It was a high velocity sale day, and just wasn't caught in time. And only a week or 2 weeks later did we start realizing, when these customers started calling in and saying, hey, what happened? Where is this? Where is that? And Tracy was dealing with each one individually. And eventually she unpicked a pattern. And then when she pulled the thread, she's like, oh, it's 1,000. She came to me and she said, look, you know, I'm going to have to hire 6 extra people. I'm going to have to get on the phones. I've got to pass all these credits. I've got to do all this stuff. But she said, if I could have seen that happening in real time, I could have stopped it. I could have turned off that item from the storefront. and this wouldn't have happened. And that was where the concept of, wait, I can fix this reactively by throwing people at it after the customer's complained, after they're frustrated, after they've had a bad experience, what I could have proactively prevented it from ever happening. And that was the light bulb moment for us. It was like, oh, wait, it's built the wrong way around. Customer service is rewarding itself for fixing problems fast versus preventing problems.
Yeah.
And we're like, instead of customer satisfaction score, let's talk about complaints prevented. And that's where where it landed for us, where we could clearly see there was this, that no one had seen it from the other angle. Prevent a complaint from happening versus triaging a complaint after it. It's the classic, eat an apple a day, keep the doctor away, you know.
Right, right.
Treat the cause, not the symptom.
I mean, it makes sense when you say it, but I think about companies out there. They're tackling the problem, the complaint, the customer complaint problem. There's a company here in Utah where I'm located. I think they just raised $80 million not too long ago, called Redo, and they basically are. I don't know that they're tackling complaints specifically, because I they're not a client, so I don't know their business model intimately. But they're tackling the product return process, which is, I think, very closely tied to the customer complaint process, right? Like we're returning the product for some reason, and if we couldn't, if we have trouble returning it, or if we're returning it because there was a problem, like this is, they're in there, but they're certainly on the after side of it, not the before side of it, right?
Yeah. And I mean, their product's providing one specific part of the order journey.
Well, so as you and your partners, did you implement this? Like, why not just build this where you were at? Why start a new company around it?
Just a quick note about our guests. I host the Breakout CEO podcast to share behind the scenes insights from scaling businesses. As an attorney, I see the real challenges leaders face long before success becomes public. But client stories have to stay confidential. So we invite guest CEOs to share their own moments of struggle and success. I'm so grateful to our guests and my team at Intellectual Strategies for making this show possible. Now, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, Jeff, we actually did that. We built what we called an MVP initially and rolled it out where we're at. And we didn't realize what we'd actually built. It wasn't like it was like, oh, great, this thing started delivering results. Very rudimentary product. It's totally unrelated to what we've built today, like light years apart. We built this sort of internal system, and it was more of an early warning system than it was anything else. And it was like able to drive efficiencies, and it was super good. And we saw a reduction in workload. We saw a reduction in tickets, an increase in customer engagement, increase in employee engagement, all these positive things. And then I left that company and I went to another one to do what I'd done there, a sleepwear brand called Papinel. Mm-hmm. And I walked in and there were 110 help desk tickets to orders, 110%.
So there were 100 for every order you had 1.1 okay
tickets.
Oh wow.
So every order had a ticket. So every order that had ever been shipped out of that company had a ticket, meaning that it had a bad customer experience.
What should the ratio be in a healthy business?
When we speak to companies, a healthy is below 10, but it's generally floating around about 20%, if not 30%.
Okay.
Of orders have got a ticket.
So this was close to four times that.
Oh, it was just crazy. It was off the charts, right? And not all of those are where is my order tickets. Probably half of all tickets, 40 to 60% of all tickets are where is my order. The rest are like just basic inquiries about the product or about a service delivery or offering. It can be triaged by what we call reactive AI.
Okay.
So reactive AI can answer questions that have got out of a knowledge base. Proactive AI, which is what we're building, can prevent problems. Versus just answering questions. So it's truly agentic. But I walked into this company, had the same problem. The dire situation. And I called up Tracy and said, oh, do you want to come across and help me fix this? And called up Tahir and said, do you want to come across and help me fix this? And And then when we looked at it and thought about building that internal system again, that's when the light bulb went off for us. It's like, if there is no solution like this off the shelf and we've got to build it again, surely there should be an opportunity to build this as a company.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where the light bulb went off for us. Only then, only a few years later.
I see. And then you're like, hey, let's try this. So so at some point you left that company, the three of you are building this new product. What's that journey been like from then for the last 2 years or so, I think it's been, right?
Yeah. Anything but linear, anything but straight, anything but easy, no straight line, no finish line. Only canyons, rivers, mountains, oceans, and seas, and polar caps, anything but straight.
So pretty typical.
Pretty typical. And I remember when we walked, we got into this startup accelerator in Australia called Startmate. And Startmate is the YC of Australia, like highly regarded, okay. You know, low acceptance rate, only 10 startups a year getting it. And we're pre-product, pre-revenue, you know, we had a pitch deck. That was about it, like nothing else. And yeah. just vision and just craziness.
Hopes and dreams, yeah.
Yeah, hopes and dreams, craziness. And we got in and I remember, and we thought our product was rock solid, that we're going to have product market fit like this. Like, and we
because you've been there, you'd seen it.
I've seen there. Like, we know yeah. we've got this. Like, we've lived it. And we were doing a workshop with an early stage VC around how to pitch, and she I'll never forget her saying this. She said, "Today your product is shit." You don't think so, but it is shit. And I can tell you today, in 24 months, your product will look nothing like it looks like today. And I was like, "What is she talking about? She doesn't know our product. Our product rocks."
Yeah.
Oh man, could we have not been any more wrong? Because, you know, we got it in your hands and, you know, that was like a really a key thing. We got the product to the users' hands and they started using it. And then, you know, as time kind of ran along, we started going, well, they're not loving it as much as we love it. And what? We started engaging with, around functionality, like it started becoming, I don't quite know how to phase it up. It was, we thought it was crushing it. We thought it was a painkiller. But mm-hmm. then we get some feedback like, oh, no, this is a vitamin. I can do this myself. It's easy. I can do that. I can do this. And it sent us back to the drawing board on multiple occasions.
So this was – you're using kind of the classic like shark bite versus, you know, vitamins. Like
yeah, exactly.
You weren't solving the biggest pain that they had. Even though it was a pain you had experienced yourself – something between what you built and how the user was experiencing it wasn't delivering the same level of impact that you thought it would. Is that right?
The pain, the problem we're solving didn't change. It was the solution we were applying to it. It wasn't a painkiller. It was a vitamin. It was good, but not groundbreaking. Not like I can't live without this. And that to us was, we were able to detect the reason why, but it still required people to do the work. And so this was our first big insight when someone said, I really like that you're showing me all the problems, but now I've got to fix them. And before I didn't know about them. And now you're actually creating more work for me because I'm having to fix these things. And that's when we were like, oh, we need automation.
Yeah.
We need to automate work. You know, to automate work. And that was the light bulb moment for us.
Okay. So it sounds like this is a role I'm very familiar with as an attorney. I get to go into companies. I'm like, well, let me tell you all the problems that you got going on. And they're like, don't tell me that. I don't want to know all that. Like, I was fine until you walked in the door. I had one question and now I have 12 questions because you just made me wonder if I've got other problems that I should be doing that I didn't know about. Is that a little bit like what you're explaining?
100%. And so they were really happy just sweeping these unhappy customers yeah. under the rug, right? They didn't know they existed. The silent churn I was talking about.
Yeah, because like, they weren't even calling, right? They weren't even calling.
Now you're telling me about all these people that have got problems and now got to do all this work. And I was like, yeah, but don't you want to protect your customer lifetime value? You don't want to keep all your customers happy. Like, you know about it. But the thing is, we were creating more work through that process of detecting the issue in real time. And we thought that would be helpful, but it was actually not. And until we then realized, well, we've got to automate that work. So detect and automate fixing it. That's when we realized that that's the painkiller, is automate all this work.
What do you think people were doing before this? Were they aware of the kind of the silent churn that you mentioned, or were they oblivious to it, or were they aware and they just said it's happening, but what are we going to do? Like, it just happens. It's part of the game.
No, because I don't think they're really actually with thinking that way. They think that every time a customer has a problem, they reach out and it becomes a help desk ticket, and then they measure how fast did first response time, resolution time, customer satisfaction score. And if those three metrics are good, they're like, oh, we're crushing it. We're crushing it because we're fixing a problem no customer wanted, and we're doing it really well. You know, and that's just backwards thinking, right? Like, and then you've got the e-commerce department that is measuring their success on customer lifetime value. And customer lifetime value is, I bought something, I had a great experience, I'll come back and buy again and again and again.
Yeah.
Now, they measure customer lifetime value. How does e-commerce improve it? They send out more emails and more nurture emails. Like, oh, yeah, we haven't seen you in a month. Would you like to come back with this offer? And so you've got these two sides of the business, one measuring customer lifetime value through retention marketing, and the other one measuring customer happiness through fixing a problem. And they're just not on the same page. Like, it's two totally different things. And I keep saying, if you throw emails out at people all the time and they've had a bad shopping experience, they're just never going to come back. Yeah. So just get the fundamental shopping experience right. And we're in this, we call it the age of anxiety. When you hit the buy button, you don't know if you're going to get your order on time. And it's a really uncomfortable feeling for a shopper. There is no guarantee it's going to always arrive as promised, especially that gift, that one thing you really want to arrive on time for, like Valentine's or Christmas or a birthday.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee. And so we're hell-bent in making sure that the term "where is my order" never exists in e-commerce again. It's just gone. It doesn't exist. Everything will arrive on time as promised.
I love it. So I mean, in a sense, you weren't tackling an entirely new market, but you were attacking the silent part of the market that existed, but didn't exist, where the companies were gamifying the actions that they took, and so it existed quietly in the background while they played with other pieces of the puzzle, but were ignoring probably a pretty, as you said before, in the U.S., 1 out of 5 orders don't arrive as intended or something like that. And that's a large piece of the puzzle to just say, well, that's not where we've gamified our statistics and our team. So we're not going to address that.
Yeah. Well, they make their problem look good by measuring fixing something that was a bad experience. It's like, oh, we're sugarcoating it. Right.
Yeah.
So what we're actually doing is just preventing that from all, we're saying that the concept of a help desk is built the wrong way around. The concept of a help desk should be proactive. It should reach out. It should fix things before the customer knows there's a problem. And so we are reinventing the way the problem needs to be fixed. At the end of the day, customers just want to feel comfortable when they hit the buy button that they're going to get what they ordered on time. That's it. And how that gets solved can be done from a multiple different angles. We just think the way it's been done with help desks is dated. It's been like that for 20 years. And there's a new future. The new future is preventing that complaint from ever happening.
And you said that you had to go back and rework your pitch, essentially rework your product, so it doesn't just diagnose the problem, it also solves the problem. How did you come to that conclusion? Did your team just say, I mean, was it customer interviews where you're getting the feedback and they're just saying, you're giving us problems and, you know, but you're not solving them? Was it that simple, or was there more to the conversation with your team?
There were two conversations, one that my co-founder had with the customer and the other with that I had with the customer, and they came from two different angles. The one that I had was, it was really great that I didn't know about these problems. Now I've got to do this work. I was like, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard in my life.
Ignorance is bliss, though.
But ignorance is bliss. And then the other, my customer, my co-founder spoke to a customer and she said, oh, when things get really busy, I've got to focus on fixing the tickets because I'm measured, my measure of success is against fixing tickets. And that's when we realized we're not placing enough value on preventing tickets. And how do we do that? We've got to take the work on. We've got to take the work off people's hands. Like there is entire teams that are there manually triaging every single ticket after the fact, going into systems, creating new orders, canceling orders, updating orders, refunds, placing stuff in back order, chasing up. There are all these people doing this manual work. And through those two sort of customer insights, we got an understanding that automating this work is the real win here. But doing that, highly complex. Like we've been building to get to a point. It's taken us a year and a half to build the tech to be able to do that. And we've gone down a bunch of different paths. We're now confident we're going down the right path with the technology. And we're starting to get momentum because to be able to automate this work, every single e-commerce business is different. They've got different tech stacks, different SOPs. Mm-hmm. How do you make it easy to connect all these systems together? Then how do you make it easy for teams to build these automations specific to their environment? How do we get those automations deployed and production ready and tested on live customers? Because you can't test these things on unlive data. You've got to test them on live data. So there's that part. The biggest part is like, sometimes a failure will only happen once every 3 days, or it can happen 10 times in a day. So how do you test waiting for that failure to happen? And so there's been a bunch of stuff we've had to solve, but we're now starting to get traction. We're getting more and more customers adopting these automations because we've made it easier for them to build, easier for them to deploy.
Okay. I appreciate that. And there's so many ways to take this conversation. The way I'd like to explore this a little bit though, is going back to your MBA program that you went through. When I did mine, one of the classes I loved was a change management class. There's also another service design class that I really loved. But as I listen to what you're explaining, and you're talking about building AI to address these problems, you are really having, I think, to change how companies fundamentally think about the problem, because they were staffing up customer service to solve issues that were disclosed to them, and you're saying, and you're almost saying, well, that's going to exist, but we want to minimize it as much as possible. You actually need a proactive team or tool to act, if in an ideal world to never have to need a customer service team again. That's like that's not just a more efficient team, right? That's a different framework that you're trying to establish. How was that received when you started presenting the problem in from that perspective? Did you get people in the customer service saying, well, I don't know how to process that because it's like I have my KPIs, this is what I do. You're saying you want to do something so that I'm not needed anymore? Or how did that conversation go?
Yeah, so there's a couple parts to that. There's the journey around convincing people that proactive is better than reactive. That was the first big part. Like, oh, we've got the solution that can proactively prevent this from happening versus reactively fixing it after. We certainly have come into this conversation knowing that we're creating a category. Creating a category becomes about telling a story, about building a narrative around it. We certainly know that we're on the back foot as a result of that, because not only are you trying to sell a software as a solution product to an e-commerce business, which is hard already, you're having to sell a new category.
Yeah.
And getting that message across really succinctly is pretty hard. We're now saying when we pitch to customers that we haven't yet engaged with, we're like, every order is a promise, Kiyu keeps it. Or we automate work. It's like, keep the promise. Yeah. Kiyu keeps the promise. Because that's what it is. Every order is a promise. We keep it. But then you go down a level lower and you're like, we can automate all that e-commerce operations work, or we can automate all your e-commerce work. And you are right, because when you sit in front of different stakeholders, when you're selling in, you've obviously got the economic buyer and you've got the champion and you've got the user. Mm-hmm. The user can sit there and say, well, hang on a sec, where's my future in this? And we're like, no, we got to augment teams. this isn't fully automated. We want you guys to be involved in the process. We want you to manage our agents. You're just doing less heavy lifting, manual, repetitive work. And that frees you up to spend more time on the phone with your customers, proactively reaching out to them, talking about great things about your brand. So we're not yet to wipe out a whole team. We got to say your team shouldn't be doing tickets all day. They should be having conversations, human to human conversations with your customer. Let our automations do the heavy lifting, the manual work, and your people are used for what they do good, which is engage with your shopper, engage with your customer, talk with them. So there's a bit of a shift in the narrative, but when you go up to the economic buyer, they're like, what efficiencies can I get for my business? What sort of savings? So you got these competing priorities when you're trying to sell the product.
Yeah, that makes sense. What are some of the things that you thought would go more smoothly as you did this transition, but maybe took a turn differently than you expected? Because you're trying to solve the problem, and then you're like, wait a second, we've had this realization that we've got to attack the problem more thoroughly, right? Or whatever. We got to talk about customer experience as what it should have been in the beginning, which is deliver the product as promised instead of resolve customer complaints when things go wrong. So you're trying to bring the perspective back and build your product to help facilitate all this. What things went right and what things went sideways on you?
Yeah, so I'll actually go back to when you said, we were speaking about Amazon earlier, and you just said something that hit me, and it reminded me what Jeff Bezos said. Jeff Bezos said, the best customer service is if the customer doesn't need to call you, doesn't need to talk with you, it just works.
Yeah.
I mean, no customer service is the best customer service, meaning you don't have to engage with the customer. It just works. No one really wants to be reaching out to a customer service department. Like, when you hit that bar button, you don't say to yourself, oh, I would love to spend the next couple hours of my life chasing up something that I ordered that you got wrong. But so we landed on that specific situation where we said, okay, great, we've got to automate this work. So we were clear in knowing what we had to do. And that was about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. But a year and a half ago, it was largely generative AI, like LLM answer and ask questions. Agentic hadn't really started hitting.
Yeah.
Hitting yet. The LLMs weren't pushing that out. We certainly can't use LLMs or any of the agentic stuff right now to run what we're doing. We've had to build our own custom code to be able to run these agentic automations. We went down the path of using technology that was off the shelf, like LangChain, LangGraph, and it just failed. And so we've had to go back to the drawing board and rebuild. We actually on our third iteration to solve this problem with the tech. We finally believe we've nailed it now. But essentially, that was the part. We had the insight, oh, we've got to automate this. Then it was like, okay, great. We've got to automate it. Now, how do we automate it? Very easy having the insight. Then trying to figure out how to do that. Already a problem that someone else had once said to us, that e-commerce founder, 600 million guy, said it's impossible to connect all these systems together. Mm-hmm. He said that's impossible. Okay, we did that. Great. Now we've got to figure out how to read, write, automate workflows across all these systems and mimic them in different environments for different companies with different SOPs and different processes and different customers' expectations. So that was probably the hardest journey, I think. And then I will say the toughest part was the beginning of last year, we're like clear on what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
We're like, okay, we've got to build these automations now. And we'd been building for a year and a bit. Raised a bunch of money. I think we raised just shy of $1 million to do that. And we burned through all of that. And now we're like, oh, we've got to do a pivot.
Okay.
But we've run out of money. And so we've got to go raise on this pivot. And we've got to go raise on this pivot with no money. And the day we started raising, we probably had about like $5,000 in our bank account.
Oh, okay? Wow.
And you got three founders and four devs in Pakistan.
Yeah.
$5,000. No, actually, I'm not telling the truth. There was 15. And three of us looked at each other as founders and we said, all right, we've built something for a year and a bit. We've tested it. We don't have product market fit. We believe this next phase is automation. We believe it will solve the problem. What are we going to do? Are we going to go ahead and raise again with an MVP, mm-hmm. with a new pitch, or are we going to give up? And the three of us looked at each other and we said, no, we're going to go raise. We're going to keep going. We didn't pay ourselves for 3 months while we were raising. We turned off all our cards, like, you know, the cards to pay things.
Yeah, yeah.
So that all subscriptions would bounce. And when we had to pay for the servers, we would turn the card on for all of 1 minute so my co-founder could process the server payment.
Yeah.
Turn the card off so no other, like, subscribers that you can't cancel would jump in and take money out of the bank account.
Wow.
And we did that for 3 months while we were raising. And, yeah, we managed to, you know, do a really good job closing out our pre-seed round on the basis of, hey, we believe this is the future. We believe that automating this work for e-commerce businesses will change its relationship with customers. And we raised $2 and a bit million on that. And then we set about building the automations, and we just raised $4 million, just shy of $4 million. So total, we raised $7 million now on this sort of dream around, like, oh, we can automate work for e-commerce businesses so customers always get what they want on time. And it hasn't been easy. Those 3 months when we had nothing, tests anyone's strength around belief in the problem they're solving.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are tough times, especially if you're raising when you need it, not before you need it. Right. So you've got more urgency to the story and maybe less negotiation power in the conversation sometimes. So how was raising the second time or the last time? How was raising the last time different from the first time? Cause you kind of, you know, like you said, you raised $1 million, you went through the MVP process and you're like, wait, this is not it. Going back, did you go to the same investors? Did you go to different investors? Like what did that look like for you?
Yeah. So the first round of investors were angel investors. Well, first of all, there was Fool's families and friends. I put some money in and a few family members put some money in. Fool's families and friends. Then we got into the accelerator program. And then at the same time, we got a bunch of angels to invest. So that first round we did that was shy of $1 million was angel investors, accelerators, and Fool's families and friends.
Okay.
We also were able to use some government grants in that first year, research and development grants that were very helpful. In fact, we wouldn't be in business if it wasn't for those research and development grants because they became the lifeline for a few months of runway each financial year, probably 1 or 2 months of runway. So, you know, we really milked that. So the first round 2 and a bit years ago was just Fool's family, friends, angels, and accelerators. Second round was VCs. We had met with them a year before. And so they had a measure of success. They'd met a year before when we were raising the first round. They all passed, said, we want to see some more traction. We want to see a bit more grit. We want to see how this unravels. Well, they say, we don't see the problem. Mm-hmm. So a year later, we went back to everyone again. And that's when a bunch of people backed us last year with a $2 million round. Just recently, we closed out just shy of $4 million. So that's kind of been, I feel like in the 2.5 years I've been building, I've probably been raising 9 months out of those 2.5 years. And fundraising is the hardest job in the whole world. There is no, I've seen people post on LinkedIn, we should celebrate founders that hit annual recurring revenue numbers, not who's raised the most amount of, and I'm like, they obviously do not know how hard it is raising. Like, if you think about it, someone on the street that's begging for them to get a dollar out of someone, how hard that is at times, like, it's the same thing. Yeah. You know, you're out there convincing people that have convinced someone else to give them hard-earned money, to give you money on a very high risk situation. Like, there's a good chance this isn't going to work out. And it's exhausting. It absolutely takes you out of the business for a long period of time.
How did you change your story? I mean, because you said you went back and people had wanted to see traction, wanted to see the grit. It sounds like, and maybe I'm misinterpreting this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like traction was elusive because you were, you know, you had to build the solutions, not just identify the problems. And so when you went back, was it more grit than traction at that point?
When you do a pre-seed round, like and call it a pre-pre, which is accelerator round, that's just vision. It's all vision, and they're just backing pitch deck and they're backing a founder. They believe, oh, we can back these founders and that pitch deck is plausible. The second round, when we did the pre-seed, it's like, we want to see signs of early product market fit. We want to see signs that you've been talking to customers. We want to see signs that you've got customers that are paying you. Are those customers sticking around? Not just early signs, early signals. Have you gone through a few iterations on your product? Is the hypothesis of what you're now building make sense?
Yeah.
And we had a bit of, I think we had about 10 customers at the time. We probably had about $100,000 of revenue. So there was some indication that there was stickiness with our product.
Okay.
Some indication. And then we're like, well, we've got this part of the problem solved. We're able to stitch these together. We're able to detect. Now we believe to get us from $10,000 average contract value to $25,000, we layer in the automations.
Hmm.
And so it was about setting them in on that vision that it's one part solving, detecting the problem. The other part is now automating, fixing it.
Where do you see this going in the future? What is your 3-year plan or your 5-year plan look like for not just customers and revenue, but the team and the product itself?
Yeah. So where we are right now is we've got a great engineering team in Australia. I'm moving to the US in 2 months, so I can build out a go-to-market team there and start building out a customer support team and a marketing team. Where do we see ourselves in 3 to 5 years? I would say that we should go from our 30 customers we have today to 300 customers by the end of next year to 3,000 the year after. How are we going to do that? We're simply going to start demonstrating to these customers that we're expanding to in the US that we are able to deliver the ROI. And I would confidently say that there's no reason why we won't be doing $100 million of revenue in 5 years. It's absolutely plausible.
Yeah.
Just simply based on the trajectory of other companies in the help desk category that got to $100 million of turnover in 10 years. Of 10,000 customers, we believe we can do that, or 5,000 customers in 100 million in 5 years.
Wow. Well, and I imagine that the AI tools out there are helping you out, right? Because they're helping all the connectors and MCPs. I don't know that you can leverage those directly, but they're certainly the technology is there to be able to connect and solve and I don't know, just allow these platforms to communicate with each other in a much more integrated way than having to do it all manually. I would expect you did a lot of that in the last couple of years getting to this point. So
yeah, definitely. And I think the key part though is what you're referring to there is the ability to connect all these systems. Sure, it's a bit easier, but it's making sense of all that data and then being able to link it back to the customer promise. And so connections are just one part, making sense of the data and then being able to get that data to reliably connect back to a specific pain point and then to a specific automation. And then don't forget, we're running financial transactions and inventory. And so you've got to have a zero failure rate. Like our failure rate right now is 0.3. And we all know how LLM models can easily hallucinate, very easily. Yeah. And so we've built technology that does not hallucinate. And it's all deterministic as the technology we've built so that no failures happen, because we can't have that. Like imagine if someone should get a $1 refund and they got a $1,000 refund. Like,
yeah.
That can't happen. And so that's part of the problem. The bigger part of the problem isn't the connections. It's actually just making sure that we can build a platform that robustly solves these problems from a transactional perspective.
And is accurate. That makes sense. Well, Devin, we haven't even had a chance to talk about your professional surfing that you did when you were younger and those other things. But this has been really good. I appreciate getting a little bit more insight into the where is my order, the customer service aspect of e-commerce businesses that we work with. I will say that of all the legal things we do for our e-commerce clients, that's one that kind of stays a little further away from us until, you know, a customer complaint rises to product liability or something of that nature. So I really appreciate hearing more about that side of the business that you're working on. Is there a takeaway that you would share with other CEOs who are going down a similar journey as you? Something that you've, I don't know, we talked about confidence a little bit a while ago. Is there something that you would say, hey, if this is a tip I could give to somebody else on the same journey, or to my younger self a few years ago, what would that be for that type of person?
For a first-time founder or someone that's already building a company?
Either one. You can specify.
Yeah, first-time founder. So I'll give some feedback for a first-time founder. First-time founder is, don't build a solution and then find a problem. Find a problem and believe in that problem and then build the solution to solve that problem. You often find people go, I've got this great solution. And I'm like, well, is there a problem? Mm-hmm. And I think people often get caught up in the wrong way around. And then I think to that first-time founder, once they figured out, like, what is that problem, like we did, it's like, no, you've got to really, really believe that that problem needs to be solved, because there's going to be a million people that will tell you the problem doesn't exist. So you've really got to believe in it, and you've got to stay the course. No matter who says to you, oh, that isn't a problem, or no, that problem can't be solved, you just got to stay the course.
Yeah.
And then I think for established CEO, I would say, that's building a company, just never lose sight of like why it is that you want to solve this problem. Like, what's that burning desire? Because it gets really lonely as you're going along on the journey and you question why you do it. There's many mornings I wake up, I go, I'm just tired. And then I go, well, but I'm solving a really burning issue, a real burning problem.
Yeah.
And I know that if I am actually able to crack that, or my co-founders and I are able to crack it, and that we will change an industry, which will redefine everything. And so to that founder that's building and is already going down the path, don't lose sight of why you started solving this problem.
Wow. Well, is there something that you tell yourself on those mornings that you wake up and you're like, super tired today? What is it that keeps, like, what is that passion for you? Or is there a trigger, a keyword, a mantra? Like, how do you do that in your world?
Oh, it's called get to the coffee shop as fast as possible. Oh. Because it'll all get better when I've had my flat white, my triple shot flat white. It'll get better. Everything will get better. The second I get to that coffee shop and I've got my flat white, the rest of the day is okay.
Okay. There you have it. The solution every CEO needs right there. What was the mix there? Triple something, flat white, something?
The triple shot, flat white, almond milk.
Okay.
triple almond milk, triple shot, espresso, flat white. White's not that common in America, right? It's only just starting to come out.
I don't know. I'm not a coffee drinker myself. So you're saying stuff that I don't know about. I drink way too much soda probably than I shouldn't, but coffee is not on my list.
No, but in all seriousness, yes, the coffee does help. But, you know, when you feel like that in the morning, I just say to myself, man, I'm solving something really cool. Mm-hmm. And within 30 minutes, you're like, oh, this is good. Let me go crush it. Let me get out there today and make magic. And I often say to my team when they walk in the morning and they come through the door, I say, what magic are you going to make today? Hmm. You know, these are tech guys, right? Like So what magic you're going to make today? When you type, like, tell me what magic you're going to make. And that sort of that feeling of being overwhelmed by what you're building, like, just dissipates really quick when you start thinking about like the magic that you're going to be making.
I love that. I think that's where we end this. What magic are you going to make today? And I appreciate you, Jevon, for coming onto the show and sharing some of your magic. I mean, this is a journey that you've been on that other people maybe have not seen the details of. So you sharing that with other CEOs who are on similar journeys, I think helps kind of attack that problem that you referenced, where it's a lonely journey, but you're not the only one, right? Everybody else who's in your shoes is going on the same thing, thinking, man, this is kind of lonely, but now they've got one more tool in their tool belt. What magic am I going to create today? So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, awesome. And it's a real simple one. Like, what magic am I going to create today? Like, how hard does it get? It's all magic.
I love it. Well, thanks for coming on the show. And to our audience who joined us again for this episode, we're always glad to have you. Hope you took away some insights. If people wanted to connect with you, Jevon, or if they needed your services, remind them where they go to purchase what you're doing or to find out more.
Yeah, so it's keyu.com, K-E-E-Y-U, that's K-E-E-Y-U.com. not that hard to find, KEEYU.com, KEEYU, or you can chase me down on LinkedIn, first and last name. There's not many of me on the LinkedIn.
Hello, Jevon, thanks so much. And to our audience, thanks for joining us again on another episode of The Breakout CEO.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeff.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.